We have a mission that is to ensure that this technology benefits everyone. This isn't something that we, as a company of now 1,000 people in Silicon Valley, are going to be able to implement on our own.
So we have elections coming. Actually, we have elections in many other countries too. So how are you thinking about the impact, potential impact of AI on elections? Yes, there's a lot of concerns, but like, also, you might think about some positive aspects of this. So how are you thinking about this space?
This is why I really hate the term generative AI, because I...
You might be in the wrong company then.
I just think that it gets people to focus on the fact that this tool can write some stuff. And honestly, one of the most incredible powers that it has is its ability to read, to process information, to summarize it, to analyze it, to compare.
And one question that always comes up when I think about this is saying, how can we actually make happen that all the countries actually win on AI as opposed to just some country win and then maybe these people assume that because of that, everyone else loses. So how are you thinking of like how different countries could simultaneously win on AI? And the particular focus to me is the Global South. So how are you thinking about the road ahead here? Hey, I'm Alexander, and welcome to Before AGI. AI is not just a technology you should think about in a wake. It is something that will influence the world around us. As a result, one of the key stakeholders here will be the society, and in particular the government that represent them. So an emerging question here is, how will the government regulate this technology? But also, how will they use it and overall interact with the AI ecosystem? And this is not just about the US government, but countries all across the world, with pressing questions around national security and geopolitics arising. This is why I'm very happy to have Anna McAndrew with us today. Anna is a VP of Global Affairs at OpenAI, where she oversees OpenAI's engagement with government officials and policy issues. She's extraordinarily qualified to do that. She has, among other things, served in many national security and foreign policy roles, working with the US government, UN, NATO, and also Facebook. And now she's in this unique position as a sort of ambassador of OpenAI, helping the world to understand AI and how it could lead to a positive future. Anna, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so you are the VP of Global Affairs, which I presume means that you kind of oversee all the interactions between OpenAI and the rest of the world. So that's my presumption, but what is your job really about? Tell us about this.
It's a unique team because normally in a company, in a tech company, the job of someone who's doing a lot of the government relations would be just to figure out how to make all of the regulations favorable to the products you're trying to deploy. But because OpenAI has this mission to benefit all of humanity, we really have to think about how to work with governments to make sure that the technology actually does have the most beneficial impacts it can, and what is the policy infrastructure that's necessary to make that happen.
Okay, great. So you joined OpenAI in 2021. That was a very different time. So can you tell me, like, how did your job look like at the beginning? How did it change with the release of ChatGPT, and how is it evolving now?
So honestly, I joined OpenAI in part because I believed that this transition would happen. But even though in 2021, OpenAI was fairly well known here in Silicon Valley, it was still a relative unknown for most people in government. But I wanted to basically get governments to start early, to think about the impacts of these things as quickly as possible before it became a crisis, to give them time to plan. But, you know, in government, it's like you only have 24 hours in a day, and people are dealing with wars, and at the time, COVID still, and, you know, economic, what was potentially going to be a huge economic crisis. So it was quite difficult to get people's attention. And I will just give you one example that I actually, maybe 2 months before ChatGPT was released, I tried to convene a bunch of university leaders to say, look, I'm going to give you an early preview of what is coming, which is GPT-4. Just to show you that these tools are going to be potentially transformational for higher education. We should really start thinking about this and talking about this. And people came and they kind of listened and they said, okay, interesting, I guess. And, you know, then they went on and said other things. And then ChatGPT came out. And after that, you know, since then, I've never been able to respond to the emails in my inbox.
Yes. Well, I'm sure MIT was not one of those universities. Maybe don't answer that. But yeah, so there is something you already said, that kind of, you know, normally this job entails really like just making sure the regulations are okay for the company, but that's not at OpenAI. So OpenAI really wants to engage policymakers in particular. Why? Can you kind of explain more?
We have a mission that is to ensure that this technology benefits everyone. This isn't something that we, as a company of now 1,000 people in Silicon Valley, are going to be able to implement on our own. Governments are, one, the biggest provider of services, and that is one of the areas that I think can be dramatically accelerated, and where we can see real benefit for people. But also, without a policy infrastructure that is enabling for this technology, and I don't just mean regulation, I mean thinking about how all of the ways in which governments helps their citizens, but, you know, include regulation, I just don't see how we can achieve our mission without a partnership with government.
So Arshad, could you tell me what the mission is? I know it, but, you know, I would want our listeners to know it as well.
The mission is to ensure that artificial general intelligence benefits all of humanity.
Great. And now you say it's like policy infrastructure that goes beyond regulations. Can you give me an example of what would be, that is not a regulation, but kind of something that on the policy side that will be needed for this mission to be fulfilled?
Well, first, governments need to use this technology. That is for a number of reasons. You know, at this point, we have, I believe, 96% of all Fortune 500 companies using our tools. And that's wonderful. But that still means that only a certain segment of the population is benefiting from them. Governments, you know, they help people connect with resources that don't have, you know, the means to feed their families. In many countries, they help farmers, you know, identify where to plant on their land. They deliver all kinds of services that can be massively scaled and accelerated with these tools. And so governments must use them to help their citizens. Also, there are lots of policies that I think may need to be put in place if this transition goes as quickly as I think many of us think it might, to ensure that there is the sort of, for example, the government of Singapore recently announced that anyone over the age of 40, they will pay for them to get another degree. Because, you know, there's this understanding that your skills, if you got a college degree 20 years ago, may very well be outdated. And I think, I can't remember who said this first, but really, I don't see this technology as technology that's going to, you know, replace all jobs. But certainly, it is the case that many people will be replaced by other people who are able to use these tools. And so, you know, really being able to be conversant to them and using them is really going to be critical.
Yeah, by the way, this is something that is also very important to me. It's just exactly like the question is not, can we deploy this technology to many people? Because we can. The question is, can we make sure that kind of people that might not be the first one to be the early adopters, they will not be the early adopters. They were not kind of left behind. Essentially, they can really learn how to use this technology, how it can be useful to them and empower them for the future. So I very much resonate with that. So going back to this, you know, working, interacting with the government. So one quite unique thing that OpenAI did, essentially Sam Altman went on this tour, you know, the global tour. It's like, you know, that's quite unusual, I think, for a company CEO to do it. And I think the architect of that was you. So how was it? And what did you learn from this this whole endeavor?
So as I said, one of the theses that I had from early on is that we really had to help governments understand this technology. Sam is an incredible ambassador for this technology. And in a world where there are still lots of skeptics, even today, you read all the time saying, this is overstated, this technology is, you know, hitting a wall, or it's underperforming.
I've heard that before.
This obviously hurts government's ability to prepare, because they believe, you know, do we really need to be prepared now? Do we really need to prioritize this on the long list of other things that need to be prioritized in a really complex geopolitical environment? And part of the purpose of all of the world leaders that we saw on this world tour is to say, yes, you have to prioritize this. It's important to think about it. We want to help you understand where this is going. Even if we are not yet going to tell you exactly how to steer it, we just want to make sure that you have a sense of kind of the technical advancements that are happening and the potential impact they might have for your people.
And do you think they got it? Like, do you think they really got this message, internalized it?
I think a lot of people did.
So what kind of questions did they ask the most often?
I think one of the most interesting things is that while pretty much every government had some version of, you know, how do we balance the potential benefits with mitigating the risks, where people landed on that spectrum really depended on where you were. In the global south, people are much more focused on not being left behind. Of course, they also want to mitigate the risks, but they want to know, how can we help solve our societal challenges using these tools? How can we make sure that we have enough access? And how can we make sure that we are part of this conversation versus, you know, the conversation in the US and Europe, at least at that time, was much more like, what is the regulation we need to put in place to prevent the harms?
Yeah, so this kind of reminds me like a story which I might have said about before in some previous of the podcast, in previous podcasts, but essentially the story about, like, there was a panel that we organized at MIT, and there was one person from European Union, one person from Africa. This is exactly what you said. It's just the person in European Union said, oh, about all the rights, how to make sure it, like, we should not be using, this is about health, we should not be using, like, medical AI because all these concerns, which are real concerns. But then this person from Africa said, wait. For us, it might be either an AI doctor or no doctor at all. So let us decide where we do draw the line. So that's a very interesting kind of different perspectives on that. So yeah, that's a great point.
You know, we're actually working with this amazing partner that will allow people to access this information via phone. So you can just call on like a regular landline or cell phone, even if you don't have a smartphone, and get access to a medical chatbot. And this is for villages where people now have to walk a couple days to see a doctor to get some very basic information. So you can imagine how this can be really transformative, again, for people who previously had no access. Even if this is not the 100% solution, if you're going to a 90% solution from a 0% solution, that is pretty remarkable.
Yes. So going back to conversations with the policymakers, so you told me like what are the questions they usually ask about. What do you think, well, what they didn't ask you about, but do you think they should?
You know, one of the things that happens a lot in these conversations is people say, yeah, we know that this can have a really great impact, but like, what are the regulations we need to put in place? So even though people acknowledge that there is theoretically some positive impact that could potentially occur, I think this still feels very remote to people. And so very few conversations were like, well, what do you mean when you say positive impact? It's part of the reason that there's an entire sub-team of our, you know, my team that does just this. They just think about, how do you actually get this technology into the hands of people that are doing the best things? Like, what are the things that we can imagine that we really want this technology to do? If people aren't doing them, we need to help. We need to make sure that these things are happening. And so you really don't have that many kind of, you have a lot of detailed conversations of harms around harms and risks, understandable, very important. But you very rarely have actually quite specific conversations on what are the benefits for a specific society. I think Japan is a real exception there, because unlike everyone else, where there's a lot of anxiety about what jobs can be, can be impacted, there's real anxiety that there are just not enough people to do jobs. So they really, they're like, please take some jobs, because otherwise, you know, we won't really have the workforce that is necessary.
Yeah, it's again shows that like this impact and risks of AI are very different depending of which country or even which community we are part of. So that's a great reminder. So going back to this global tour, so again, it sounds like a crazy endeavor. Like, I don't know how many countries you visited in how short of a span of a time. So I'm sure you slept a lot during that time. But can you tell us what is the most memorable kind of anecdote from that trip?
Actually, this will resonate with you because, yes, I think we were sleeping a couple of hours a day. And there were things that, I mean, I really feel like when I first called a friend when we were, and this Sam wanted to go on this world tour. He wanted to talk to developers. I think he maybe was less indexed around the fact that so many world leaders would also be interested in having this discussion. But there was a day where we had three countries in one day. So we had a meeting with the Prime Minister of Poland in the morning.
A good country, I hear, has great people.
Yes.
Out there.
I think, recruited most of them, right?
Still some left.
Then we had President Macron in the afternoon, and
oh my gosh,
the entirety of the UK government that evening. And I had, because we were planning this trip with essentially two people, I was sleeping about it a couple of hours a day because I was trying to also prepare, you know, what we were going to discuss, plus the logistics, plus everything else. And I was so stressed out that I set this meditation app to try to fall asleep at 3 a.m. to wake up at 5. And the meditation app disabled my notifications. So Sam called me, you know, 10 minutes past the time we were all supposed to leave and said, so you're still coming to this? Of course, the worst nightmare. But I managed to somehow get dressed and get into a taxi, you know, to follow them, and made it maybe 30 seconds before the Polish delegation walked in. So that was really...
Well, the country of Poland, thank you for for making it in time. So yeah, okay, that's pretty crazy. Yes, so going back, so you say that, you know, just the policymakers, they tend to like zero in on regulation, which is not a bad thing, not a bad instinct. So can you just walk me a little bit about like what is the current like regulatory thinking around AI around the world? Like what are the main trends? What are the things that, you know, kind of different ways of thinking about this around the world?
So you probably may have seen that Senator Schumer just released his AI framework today, and it really tries to address as many of the aspects of this technology, from infrastructure to actually immigration to job training to potential civil rights impacts. And this just demonstrates the real difficulty of getting your hands around the vastness of this question. Of course, the EU has now put in place a framework that, while it is much more sort of specific than many places, it's still very notional. I wouldn't know how to tell our engineering colleagues how they have to, you know, develop or deploy the next system based on what is currently in the UAI Act. So there will be several months and years of thinking through implementation. But that is probably the most hard regulation that exists today. Then, of course, there's the G7 Hiroshima principles, which tries to create a global framework. And this is really critical because this technology is global. And if we have this patchwork where there is no overlap at all and no coordination between governments, it's going to be pretty impossible for any company to really function. So everyone's hoping that there will be some global consensus. The UN is running a process that MIRA is a part of. There's a G20 process. And actually, there are probably 800 pieces of individual legislation introduced just in different states in the United States. So we could potentially have a world where we have different laws by state. Obviously, that's probably not a way that we want to address it. But just to say that there's also so much just imperative now for people to regulate that there are lots of proposals being put on the table. And we are trying our very best to keep up with them and figure out where it makes the most sense for us to engage. Actually, we did endorse a piece of legislation this week as well. So this is the Klobuchar-Hawley bill on deceptive use of AI in elections. And we endorsed this because we feel that this is a whole of society problem. There are a lot of things that we're doing, but without ensuring that every actor in the ecosystem is also being contributing to the solution, this isn't, you know, OpenAI alone is going to be able to solve this.
Well, OpenAI can solve many problems, but definitely not this kind. So, but could you tell me more about this bill? Like, what is this bill about?
The bill is basically around disclosure and around limiting certain deceptive uses of AI. I think there's one principle that pretty much everyone can agree on, which is that people should know if they are interacting with artificial intelligence. And this is particularly important in elections where, you know, persuading people is going to have such a critical impact on the outcomes of entire countries and governments. So this is really meant to make sure that there are constraints beyond what AI or social media companies are going to do on their own platforms.
So can you tell me more what's in the bill?
Sure. The bill is actually focused on ensuring that, on preventing the distribution of deceptive audio, images, or video of political candidates in federal election advertising.
Okay, so definitely a very timely,
yes.
Timely issue, and the one that we want to get right. So actually, speaking about elections, right? So we have elections coming. Actually, we have elections in many other countries too. So how are you thinking about the impact, potential impact of AI on elections? Yes, there's a lot of concerns, but like also you might think about some positive aspects of this. So how are you thinking about this space?
So this is actually, I would say, probably the number one topic that comes up with many stakeholders, because there are so many concerns right now about the future of democracy in general. And there are a lot of things that we're already doing as a company here to prevent the use of our tools to prevent our tools to be used in a way that negatively impacts democracy. And we had a recent takedown that we had a blog post on how some foreign governments were attempting to use our tools. Make sure that people cannot disseminate political content at scale, for example, by creating a political chatbot. And we also have done a number of things, like we have entered into an accord at the Munich Security Conference to ensure that we are working together across the ecosystem, because, you know, people can create content using our tools, but the key is how it will be disseminated. So how can we partner with this, you know, social media platforms or others where this will be disseminated to ensure that you know, we're looking at the whole ecosystem. We just announced last week a societal resilience fund to help people really understand AI. But I do think that one of the things that makes, I think, a lot of people here really hopeful is the potential for these tools to help get people assistance with high quality education. And educated populace is one of the biggest assets to democracies. And you know, if these tools can help assist there, I think that this will actually ultimately have a positive impact for democracy. And, you know, of course, the fact that we are able to leverage our tools to prevent a lot of dissemination of disinformation at scale. So we actually have, this is a tool in our pocket to prevent those kinds of things.
Yes. So, by the way, I think like thinking about the technology in election is not new to you. At Facebook, essentially, you were also thinking about election integrity. So what are the lessons about this kind of different technology and elections that you learned there? And how many of them are actually applicable still when you think about AI and elections?
Not just at Facebook, but I actually worked at the White House during the 2016 Russian election interference and sort of watched it play out in real time. And one of the things that I think also people believe is that we kind of discovered Russian election interference in 2016. In fact, I had been part of a working group for a couple of years in the White House to try to think through what to do. And one of the things that we did not do at that time is really engage with tech companies, partly because tech companies were not in a place where they had that type of personnel that we could really sit down with them and work through these problems. And so this is where I feel that we really, there's a lot of good news. None of us are coming to this without the benefit of hindsight. And so one of the things OpenAI has done and many other companies have now done is they've looked at the lessons and they've looked at the fact that you really have to think and prepare and make sure you have, you know, linguistic understanding, that you're looking at things in context, that you're working with local communities on the specifics of the elections, and that you really have to put these pieces in place well in advance to be prepared for the kinds of things that happen around the election time.
Yes. So, well, hopefully everything will work. Like, again, technology is, of course, only part of the solution, but it's an important part. So kind of going back to thinking about kind of all the regulatory efforts, well, OpenAI, in particular Sam Altman, repeatedly said that actually, like, OpenAI is definitely like pro-regulation. So what kind of regulation do you think, like, you know, OpenAI would endorse, or kind of how are you thinking of what would be the helpful and effective way to regulate AI?
So one of the things that we believe is really important is an international framework around the most severe risks of AI. And we're really encouraged that right now the U.S. government is directly engaging with China in a track one dialogue about just this question. But of course, we need to have this be an international regime that as many people as possible sign on to. We also think that, you know, a critical thing is for this technology to be for the regulatory interventions to be informed by fact and by science. This is where your work has been so incredibly helpful. This is why we actually think that the way that this ecosystem has developed with NIST's launch of the U.S. AI Safety Institute and the network of the safety institutes is really the right way to go. I mean, we even lack a common vocabulary right now to talk about these issues. So this is why it's so difficult to have regulatory interventions that are effective. And this will help us create that infrastructure that will create resilient and, frankly, regulation that can evolve with the technology. I would say this is also something the Frontier Model Forum that we launched last year is also, with other Frontier labs, is also working on.
Okay. So, and this is just about the safety mitigations, are there any other interventions that you would support as kind of needed for our future with AI?
The Klobuchar-Hawley bill is a really good example here, because there are some interventions that are not specific to AI companies, but that we play a role in, of course, because one of the ways that you identify AI, deceptive AI content, is with provenance measures that we're putting in place.
Okay. Thinking about the past and like how the regulation of technology unfolded, it was almost always, at least as far as I know, reactive as opposed to proactive. And, you know, the part of the reason for that was that honestly, technology changes so fast. By the time we kind of really wrap our heads around what should be regulated, it takes time. So that's why we're reactive. AI is moving even faster. So what's your perspective on that? Will be in the end, like, well, will we be regulating AI retroactively, or is there something proactive? Like, how are you thinking about these dynamics here?
So one thing I would say is that there is a misconception that currently no regulation is happening and it's just the Wild West. And as someone who has seen, at a minimum, many dozens of regulatory inquiries from various regulators around the world, I would say we are definitely being regulated. And there are a lot of regulatory interventions that are already possible for this technology and that are already happening. You know, fraud does not become legal just because someone is using AI to commit fraud. And so what we need to really, and what we are working to identify, is where is really the white space? And this is part of the reason why we think about the frontier, because there may not be regulatory interventions that adequately address the most cutting edge versions of these models. Right now, I think there are a lot of harms and risks of these tools that are actually addressed by existing regulatory agencies and legal approaches. So we are trying to think through where is that gap.
Sounds interesting, but like, what do you, again, I'm trying to a little bit press you. It's just like, if you think about DC, right? So again, so you mentioned that there is this like thinking about this like omnibus bill, or at least some kind of framework for this bill. But what do you think will happen next? Like, kind of, what do you think will be the timeline at which things will happen in DC? Because as everyone knows, predicting how things will happen in DC is an easy job.
Almost 100% of the time it's accurate.
Yeah.
So the reality is that this is obviously a very unsettled moment in DC. We're in the middle of a very contentious election. And I do feel a moderate amount of optimism that somehow AI regulation has managed to remain a relatively bipartisan conversation. You saw that with the Schumer bill, where there was a framework that was completely bipartisan, and you see that very rarely in DC these days. But it was also very broad. So it's my prediction is we will not see a comprehensive AI bill this year, but we may see pieces of what you saw in the Schumer framework or other individual bills, particularly in the lame duck.
Yes, so lame duck season being the time when essentially after the new president was chosen, but before they assume office. So just to explain for the one who are not DC wonks. Okay, that's optimistic. And by the way, yeah, actually, like, why do you think AI remains a bipartisan issue, given, again, so much polarization, essentially all the other issues? Why is it the case?
Part of it, of course, is that this technology can have very substantial benefit for people across the political spectrum. It does not favor any particular group. And everyone is really thinking through what is the specific way they can harness these benefits. At the same time, to be quite frank, I think there is an enormous amount of anxiety around what this technology will do. And that anxiety doesn't have, you know, political character, because the impact is across the board on entire sectors. Everyone is thinking, what should I teach my kids? People are thinking, you know, how should I update my skills? All of these things are quite broad. And the fact that our policymakers are really trying to work across party lines on this is, frankly, quite encouraging.
Okay, I'm happy to hear that. Now, one thing that is also, I would be very curious to kind of, when we talk about politicians and elections, is just like, do you think that AI will become a campaign topic? Like, for now, yes, there is a lot of interest in AI from the legislative front. It's quite bipartisan, but like, do you think that we will be seeing candidates talking about AI when they are doing their stump speeches and so on?
It feels pretty inevitable, to be honest, that people will talk about AI somehow. But that this becomes, you know, obviously one of the things that keeps me up at night the most is that it will become a partisan topic in some way. And so the hope is that the way it becomes a campaign topic is a competition around who will best harness the incredible potential of these tools. But we shall see. That may not really be the outcome. Honestly, I have nightmares about this, because for a technology so transformative to have not become, you know, in some way coming in sideways into this electoral process, it's certainly something that we may see.
I think one of the topics that might come up is potential job displacement or essentially impact of AI on that. So yeah, that might be an issue. Hopefully there will be both the negative and positive kind of version of this future that will be discussed, although unfortunately the negative one tends to kind of evoke stronger emotions. So unfortunately that's where this might be going. So I guess we will see. But now, moving away from regulation, actually governments, yes, the governments definitely regulate, but there are also the other ways in which they can kind of interact with AI's technology. They are funding some R&D research in AI. You know, they are doing this. You know, there is a number of initiatives that try to do that. They also are, and you already mentioned this, well, they could be the users of AI, actually at a large scale potentially. So what is your kind of understanding? How are governments thinking about these ways of interacting with the AI ecosystem?
So many governments are, including the US government, investing a significant amount, particularly on infrastructure. You know, there have been several significant investments into chip manufacturing in particular. And we are seeing governments really start to leverage these tools. We were just speaking with the Office of the Governor of Minnesota that is leveraging this to translate government documents into Somali, for example, where they're not, languages. Many governments have an imperative to ensure that all citizens can engage with the information that's coming out, but it's the volume. As someone who used to be a translator for government, it's very difficult to keep up with the volume. And these tools can really be leveraged for this kind of thing. There are all kinds of creative things. The city of Dublin is using it to boost tourism. In Singapore, they were using it to help people find parking. So people are experimenting quite a bit right now. We are seeing in Congress people leveraging this technology. USAID is now going to be using it. So I think that it's really, you know, the government's desire to experiment and understand how they can use it is accelerating.
But what are the key obstacles to that, right? Is it really that all the governments are rushing to use AI, or maybe just some governments, maybe some parts of the governments? Like, what is your assessment of that?
Certainly, the government has a very long process of getting comfortable with deployment of new technology. And so there's a lot of thinking of whether the compliance infrastructure that currently exists and is adequate to address these tools. You know, on even with something like email or internet search, it took government many years to become comfortable with allowing people to access this. And even now, you know, there are some agencies where they will block certain social media sites or, you know, et cetera. So this just, because governments are understandably and, you know, advisedly cautious, the adoption curve has honestly been quite slow in a way that often feels concerning, because without a workforce that is really getting comfortable with these tools right now, when they're more accessible and sort of limited in the capabilities feels like it will be a real barrier as the capabilities accelerate.
Yeah, and by the way, from what I'm hearing, some of the, you know, my friends in government, the email might still not be there to stay. Like, it's still sometimes accessing it is quite a challenge. So it's unclear, like maybe it's 50-50.
Yeah, when I worked at the Pentagon, we had, you know, several bespoke email systems that were built specifically for certain parts of the military services that often could not send emails to each other. So I know what you mean.
Okay, that's, I'm not sure if that's very reassuring, but I guess that's the reality. So we need to look into it, kind of, you know, like we want to see the truth. Coming back to this use of AI by governments, so you mentioned that like the compliance is kind of part of the part of the challenge there. Do you think that even for the positive cases, when something was like possible to do for the government to use AI, like do you think that these are the most kind of low-hanging fruits? Like, is this like, if you think about how you would want the government, so you clearly would want the government to use AI, but now if you think about how you would want to use AI, like, do you think that, would you have some suggestions?
This is why I really hate the term generative AI, because I...
You might be in the wrong company then.
I just think that it gets people to focus on the fact that this tool can write some stuff. And honestly, one of the most incredible powers that it has is its ability to read, to process information, to summarize it, to analyze it, to compare. And in fact, that's how most days I don't write anything with ChatGPT, but I read a lot of things with it. Because when I get a 600-page draft bill, it is often difficult for me to read it very
quickly.
Just
like, like a nice evening read.
When I worked at the White House, for example, every morning my CIA briefer would come with a folder of articles, both what articles the president gets that morning and a set of articles that would be responsive to the specific issues I was working on. You know, I had a portfolio of 50 countries that I covered for the vice president. I needed to understand how all of the key policy issues that we were working on were developing. So he would pull some articles that came in that day and I would read them. And now, I mean, you can imagine a world in which you could have access to all intelligence produced by every single one of the many intelligence agencies that we have in the U.S. government. And you could just have, you could be able to answer these questions in real time and also leverage a lot of this information that frankly gets produced and never makes it to a policymaker and no one will be able to read or engage with it. And so this is one of the reasons that when GPT-4 was first built, one of the experiments that we did was there was a Russian ransomware gang called the Conti ransomware gang that when Putin decided to, when this the members of this group decided to support Putin in the war against Ukraine, one of the Ukrainian members leaked their entire dark web chats on the internet. And so you had hundreds of thousands of conversations in Russian, in slang, involving code. And we were just able to use GPT-4 to summarize the entire thing, to extract, you know, to ask what were the sources and methods of this group? What were their targets? What was the relationship of different people in this gang? And so something that would have taken an analyst days and weeks, you were able to do in a couple of hours. So you could really see the power that this could have to analyze information quickly and in real time.
Okay. Connecting to this kind of question of like CIA using this for intelligence, you know, maybe you could imagine a future in which the president is briefed by, you know, ChatGPT, not by a briefer, of course, that's a joke, but like, maybe not that far from the reality. You can imagine the briefer using ChatGPT to prepare this briefing, but this kind of touches on this like very, I think, important and difficult question of using AI. Like, well, government does many things, and some of it is involved national security and military applications. So, how do you think about use of AI for military purposes? Like, what is your personal opinion? Like, what kind of uses you would view as like justified ones, which one you would view as prohibited ones, and how does it relate to OpenAI policies on this subject, which, by the way, if I recall correctly, recently changed?
So we updated our policies I think to reflect what we actually intended for them to be to begin with, because we had some very, very broad language that made it not clear where we believed that these tools should be deployed and where we felt they shouldn't be. So, for example, we had a ban that was a blanket ban on anything that related to the military. So the intention was to make sure that we were not, that the technology was not being deployed in certain lethal applications, but that's not how it read. So, for example, even before we changed our policies, we were already working with DARPA on how to ensure that we could identify any flaws in open source technology that could have vulnerabilities. So to me, this is very much aligned with our mission. We want to make sure that technology that is being used to protect critical infrastructure or to run key operations of government agencies are protected and hardened against any kind of takedowns, or, you know, like, you don't want people to be able to exploit these deficiencies to, you know, take down the electrical grid. So this is something, you know, these tools can really help with that. And but it was very unclear, based on the language that our previous policies had, that this would be possible. So we wanted to make sure the policies reflected this. I mean, we still have prohibitions against harming oneself or others, against destruction of property, and against development of weapons. But that leaves an entire universe of things that you can do and where you can really help the U.S. government be more efficient and effective.
So this makes sense. Just to make sure, like, I think that the applications that you are working on with DARPA was, it's about the code, this open source code, it's how to just like screen it for vulnerabilities. So just wanted to make sure I understood it correctly. And yes, this is kind of a quite welcome defensive kind of use of AI, that we don't want our infrastructure to have vulnerabilities. So I think everyone agrees about that. What other applications in this space you think that in particular OpenAI might want to engage with?
We have some really interesting work right now around, for example, preventing service member and veteran suicide. And of course, these are very careful processes, because when it comes to mental health, you have to work with experts and you have to really make sure that you have deployed this very carefully. Now, we actually, even with GPT-2, we saw a pretty amazing use case here where a group called the Trevor Project used this to help people train to work with suicidal LGBT teens, because what they had is hundreds and hundreds of hours of trainings that they had done with human trainers. And they were able to essentially create a chatbot that a person could practice with before they started manning the hotline. And the chatbot, they found from their analysis, was actually, first of all, you could spend unlimited time training. So it increased the pool of trainers they could have. So if you can't do it from, you know, if you can't do your training from 9 to 5, you can only do it after hours. Suddenly you're able to get the training. That people actually came out of this with more experience and expertise because of how well the chatbot could simulate the interaction. So people are actually coming in more prepared as they were, you know, interacting with real kids. And this is a really interesting application that I think could have great utility in many other spaces as well.
It's interesting, by the way, that it's like GPT-2, so yeah. Like it's a prehistory. Like,
yes.
But by now, just like it was GPT-3 and now GPT-3.5, now GPT-4. So it's interesting that this technology could also be useful before, like almost unthinkable right now. Okay, so this was about what OpenAI is doing in the context of like military application of AI. But what is, moving aside from like OpenAI, what do you think, what are your thoughts about what could be the right uses of AI in the context of the military?
So first of all, the military is, you know, an immense organization. I believe they are 3.5 million people that work for the Pentagon. The overwhelming majority of these people are not doing anything on the battlefield. They are helping to secure, you know, modernize nuclear weapons facilities. They're doing HR. They're helping service members relocate or get medical assistance, or they're chaplains who are, you know. So there are so many applications that can just help reduce the amount of, for example, if you are a service member and you need some information about a relocation, you're going to call a hotline, and on that hotline will be a person who looks something up for you in a manual and then tells you that information. Now, you know, I can see there's being a huge time saver because, you know, at a minimum, that person can just not spend time looking it up in a manual and can get an answer from an AI tool. Or you could imagine an AI tool ultimately that is going to help you get this information, freeing up lots of capacity to do other things. The military does disaster response, trainings, all kinds of quite, you know, non-combat related things that I think most people would, you know, even AIDS response. It's quite remarkable if you think about the breadth of activity that happens in the military services, you know, the Coast Guard. So, again, you can think of many things that not even just offensive weapons, but don't involve combat at all, where this technology can increase productivity and free people up to do higher value tasks.
Okay, but let me press even further. AI is used on the battlefield right now, right? It's used in Ukraine, it's used in Israel, and it will be much, much more. So what are your thoughts about, like, kind of where will AI eventually be in terms of being applied in the context of actual combat? And what do you think will be the, like, justified uses of it versus maybe not so justified? Like, how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that when I talk about AI right now, I talk about large language models or multimodal large models, not the type of AI that currently is being used in the battlefield, where obviously, the capability of these models will increase, but I think that for many battlefield applications, this technology simply isn't ready yet. Where, if the capabilities increase, where this should go is a really good question. Of course, the Pentagon is thinking about it too. They have their own AI principles. They're trying to get the world to align on some red lines around where you should not use AI and you should not replace human judgment. So certainly, I can imagine AI supporting decision makers in the way that I've described previously of, you know, analyzing large quantities of information, because they're using AI in that way helps reduce the potential for inaccuracy. But where right now we, you know, at OpenAI prohibit the use of our technology in a lot of areas simply because there are certain high risk areas where the risk of error is more impactful. You know, again, like if you're Singapore and you're using it to park, you know, to help people find parking, and there's an, you know, maybe only 90% accuracy rate, that's fine. You know, the worst thing that can happen is you don't get a parking spot. But if you're trying to select...
That's a tragedy.
You're right. That could be quite impactful. But if you're on the battlefield and you have, you know, a tool that has 90% accuracy supporting a lethal application, obviously that's not acceptable. So I would say it's really... It is a question that we're all struggling with. I think that, again, I would, for example, be, even if it may go beyond where our policies are now, in the future, helping it do intelligence analysis. To me, that's a very clear area of application. But where do we go in terms of where we need to draw the line in terms of lethality? I don't know that that's something that I would have to answer that when I see your research, Alexander.
Yes, well, I'm not doing any research about lethal applications of AI, but yes, I do work
on making
AI more robust.
I mean, on increasing capabilities. I just mean when I see where the capabilities are going.
Yes, so we are definitely trying to understand that. And by the way, just this question of robustness is extremely important, right? Like, just again, there are many, many applications where you say 95% or even 60% success rate is totally fine. And some of them, and in military battlefield context, there's almost all the applications like that, it's just not acceptable. And that's a kind of something that actually I think we as a society, and in particular as Pentagon, we should think even more. I know they do, but there is lots to understand and to improve. But again, it's not just improvement of technology. It's also about our thinking of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. Okay, moving away from military applications, if we still think about these applications of AI in the government, as you said, you really would like to have even more of them. What are the risks, though, that you could see that connect to this kind of large-scale application of AI across the government? Like, what could go wrong?
Certainly, we are always discovering, obviously, there is a potential for bias that reflects, overall societal biases. At the same time, there is also just some of it is, I think, not exactly the way that we think about bias now, which is that, you know, there will be clearly racist applications, but just certain communities that are not reflected in, you know, the data sets, there won't be answers, or there will be serious gaps, for example, in medical applications, because not enough data is collected on certain populations, and therefore it will reflect some, because the tools are not yet at a place where they are able to identify gaps in their own knowledge, they will be confident in areas where they should have no confidence in their responses. So I do think that that can certainly result in some problematic outputs, which is why all of these applications should still have some human intervention and human expertise, so that it can, again, speed up the work of government experts working on these areas, not replace their judgment. Now, I understand that there's still a problem of potential over-reliance, and that if the tool is accurate often enough, people will simply stop paying attention enough to review the outputs. So I do think it just requires additional training for people who are deploying it in contexts that can have problematic impacts.
We talk a lot already about your experiences being in the government, working on national security. And I think one of the most surprising things that I learned from you about your background, knowing that you work in national security, is actually you were born in Soviet Union. So how could this even happen that you are born in Soviet Union, like in St. Petersburg, I believe, and here you are in White House working on national security, and I believe actually on Russia. So tell me, like, you know, what have you do to prove your loyalty here?
I mean, it's the American dream, Alexander. It really is. Well, yes, I did have to renounce my citizenships that were not American, because I'm also, you know, I was also a citizen of Nigeria in addition to a citizen of Russia. And I had to pass several polygraphs in addition to extensive security screening.
But like, how you even started this conversation is like just saying, hey, I am a Russian citizen. I would want to work for the White House on national security. Like, how do you even start this conversation?
Yeah. Well, I actually think this is an interesting quirk of the American political system. I'm not sure I would have ever been able to come in as a public, you know, as a career civil servant. But because I came in through the political appointee system, this is an opportunity to really get people of a much more diverse variety of backgrounds into government. And honestly, I never had the idea of working in government, partly because I just thought that it would never happen. I was raised by a Soviet army colonel, so
God.
Did not really think it was not one of the options I was thinking about. And honestly, I was very interested in the Obama campaign, in part because my mother died of something that insurance companies determined was a pre-existing condition, and she was not able to get medical treatment. So I was quite passionate about this one issue in particular, but also generally the approach that then candidate Obama had to many foreign policy issues. And I took a leave of absence from my law firm to go work on the campaign, and I just never really ended up being able to focus on anything else. So I stayed, and then President Obama had a call with many of the organizers asking them to come into government. And I just felt like, okay, I'll do it for a year. And of course, I ended up staying for 8. And I always joke that I'm the only person working at the White House whose family was ashamed of them, because both my Nigerian and Russian family were like, wait, you were a lawyer. You had a real job and you went to work for government?
Oh my God. Well, the United States like really appreciates your service even more now, I guess. So you work kind of in Obama administration. So what is your favorite Obama anecdote? There's so many of them.
There are a lot of them. But I think the thing about President Obama that was really remarkable beyond his, you know, intellect is that he was truly unflappable. And there were just so many situations where you are internally panicking because you think the world will end and he just seems completely calm. And so you look at him and you think, well, I guess it seems like maybe we'll be okay because, you know, he's not freaking out. And even the night that the night before the election, all of us organizers had been up for probably 48 hours, but so had he. You know, because campaigning is you're going from state to state. And like us, he had to be totally on in that time. So he probably also hadn't slept at all in a week. And I think I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown because, you know, the election was about to happen. And I was just thinking, you know, what, you know, how will this go? And we had the final call with him and he just seemed completely relaxed. He was like, well, guys, that was interesting. I mean, we had a great campaign, so we'll see what happens. Okay, everybody get some rest. And I was just like, how can he be so calm?
I can tell you, he was an academic.
Yeah.
No, that's what having tenure does to you. Just like nothing
yeah,
can nothing
he
can
knows
shake
he still
it.
Has a job, right?
Exactly. So the best job ever. So, but this is actually, this is amazing. Talking about related topic of geopolitics of AI, right? Like AI is a technology that kind of now is also shaping or being shaped by the geopolitics. Yes, there are different countries that are investing in this technology. There is some competition here. So how are you thinking about the current landscape of geopolitics of AI? What are the trends that you are observing here?
So, of course, there is an intense race around advanced semiconductors. And not just between the US and China, but many countries who want to own a part of the infrastructure because this is the oil of the, you know, of the current world. And of course, also, ultimately, it is the case that the overwhelming majority of companies at the forefront of this technology are American companies. And so that means that many countries are asking themselves, how do we advance our own ability to compete here? Are there parts of this ecosystem that we can drive? You know, what is our role in this new framework? Certainly, there is a lot of concern that, like, just as with every other breakthrough technology of the past 20 years, the U.S. essentially dominates it. And there is a lot of thinking about what, you know, what other countries can do to also help shape this ecosystem.
This kind of connects to, like, I agree with this, and I think that's a very important thing also for OpenAI, with our mission to benefit all of the humanity to understand that. And one question that always comes up when I think about this is saying, how can we actually have, like, how can we make happen that all the countries actually win on AI as opposed to just some country win and then maybe this people assume that because of that, everyone else loses. So how are you thinking of, like, how different countries could simultaneously win on AI? And the particular focus to me is the Global South. So how are you thinking about the road ahead here?
This is such a great question and something that I think my team and many people at OpenAI really want to make sure we answer. Part of that is that whatever global regime around AI governance exists, it really should be rooted in benefit sharing. So if people are signing up to a certain governance of this technology, it should be with the understanding that they will also be able to reap the benefits. And we are thinking about what is the best way to do that. Part of it is that I think that given the U.S. leadership in this space, the U.S. should also lead in disseminating the infrastructure that is necessary to take advantage of this technology. And as we build the technology, we also need to take into account how it can be best leveraged by, you know, many other societies. This is, you know, one of the things I'm most, if not the thing I'm most excited about, our latest release on Monday of GPT-4o is its ability to perform so well in so many languages, as well as the fact that we have optimized the tokenizer to make it cheaper and faster to use in a lot of languages. And just that means much more access for many more communities. But also, we have thought for a long time is, you know, what do we do with languages with very few speakers or languages that are maybe not even written? We have one of the projects that we have worked on is with the government of Iceland. You know, this is Icelandic as a language that has 300,000 speakers. And
it's very easy.
Yeah. But they were able, you know, they are more anxious than anyone else about the fact that if digital technologies do not incorporate their language will die. And so they have collected a, you know, large corpus of Icelandic data that we were able to use in order to research how our tools can actually improve on small data sets, small linguistic data sets. And now we're working on how to convene other small, low-resource languages and other languages that face barriers to inclusion and really disseminate that knowledge to make sure that not just our models, but in general, people understand how to make sure that the large language model ecosystem can take into consideration smaller languages.
Okay, so this is all about the positive vision, which I very much hope will happen. And, you know, I really, like, OpenAI works towards this. I hope not only OpenAI will work towards this, but the realities are that there is a competition as well, right? So what if you kind of put your national security hat and you think about all the risks and all the kind of conflict that competition that will be happening here. So how would you view the trajectory of this competition moving forward, like in the next 5 years, 10 years?
You know, I think one of the things that's going to be really a critical tool of U.S. influence will be its export control regime. Because right now, it is certainly the case that U.S. and its allies control many of the components that are critical to advancing on frontier technology. Of course, China is working to create its own alternatives here, but the way that the U.S. is going to continue to deploy this regime around not just the semiconductors themselves, but around the technology that's necessary to manufacture them or other, you know, pieces of the supply chain is going to really shape how this develops. And right now, you know, the analysts that have talked about this believe that it will be several years before China is able to replicate any of this technology. But certainly, you know, it may be the case that they will get there. It just will be slower.
Okay, so we are talking about all this, like, competition, maybe even the race to make AI be more capable as fast as possible. And in one, on one hand, you can say this is great because AI has all these positive uses, but it also has the uses that may be less positive or actually misuses or risks that come with it. So now if you have the dynamics where countries just want to get to capable, the most capable AI as fast as possible, you might sound to be a little bit uneasy about the risk. So how do you think we should be thinking about preventing this kind of outcomes? There is a talk about international agreements, but yeah, what do you think is the best path forward here?
I do think that an international agreement around the most serious risks is essential. And I do hope that we are able to achieve some consensus there. We are engaged on this. And, you know, I think the U.S. government sees on this. And I do believe that the Chinese government is also quite concerned around some of the most, the most serious risks. So I think that it's possible that we will be able to make progress. At the same time, we are trying to work with all of the labs that are at the frontier. Again, the overwhelming majority of them are here in the United States. This is part of the reason we launched the Frontier Model Forum, is because we believe that we need to talk with our competitors around what safety best practices we all need to agree to, because we all need to make sure that exactly this dynamic that you are talking about is controlled. And at the same time, I do believe that democracies need to be the first to deploy these tools and to deploy them responsibly, in part because they should be shaping the norms in the space.
norms that we still have to work out,
yes,
by the way. So can you actually say, because you mentioned this Frontier Models Forum, can you say a little bit more about what is this organization and what is its purpose?
So the Frontier Model Forum is an organization that we launched last year with Anthropic, Microsoft, Google, and OpenAI. And the idea was partly what I had suggested earlier, is that we don't even have a common framework to think about what are the specific risks we're trying to address. What are the what does it mean to say AI safety? What are the best practices in the space that we should really be thinking about? And we should get on the same page around that, and we should set some norms for frontier companies on how to deploy this technology, in part to avoid any practices that come out of the competition.
So you say, okay, the plan is we as companies will develop the norms and what AI safety means. And then somehow this will help, in particular, the US and China to agree what not to do. Is it that simple?
No, not at all. And also just to say, of course, this is a forum to allow us to talk as companies without triggering any antitrust concerns. But the forum is actually also meant to be a mechanism to engage governments and to engage civil society and to engage experts and take their feedback as we help shape these norms, and to be one input for how, you know, when we sit around a table as a global community and figure out what are the limitations we need to put in place, that should be informed by what the actual technical realities are. And so this is just to help provide an input into that conversation that is informed by what the technology actually looks like.
Speaking of the input in the conversation and building the technical understanding, there's another set of players in this kind of landscape, namely AI Safety Institute. Like, there was the UK AI Safety Institute, that was the first one. Recently, we had the US AI Safety Institute stood up, and now we have many more. So could you tell me a little bit more what AI Safety Institutes are? What is their role, and how do you think they would be, like, what role they will be playing in this, in particular, thinking about the safety of AI more globally?
So this is a very new ecosystem, and frankly, quite impressive that from when the first AI Safety Institute was announced to now, they have already, and this was in the UK, they have already, you know, really staffed up and begun their work, and were even able to do some tests on models that exist today. Frankly, this might be record speed for a government agency from inception to actual impact. So I think
I really love how optimistic you are about governments after having worked in the government. So
yeah. And I would say the Frontier Model Forum was launched before we knew that this ecosystem would exist, but I think it can be a really strong partner to this ecosystem. And also to, you know, have collective wisdom collective experience of these companies and share it with safety institutes so that it may, you know, reduce the time that it takes to disseminate and agree on some of the best practices in the space. But of course, engagement with individual companies will be needed as well on an ongoing basis. But the safety institutes are really meant to create this scientific and you know, fact-based, measurement-based infrastructure for policies around advanced models, really thinking through what are the safety assessments that we're all going to do as companies. It makes a lot of sense that this is something that we will have government agencies set as a baseline.
And what do you think are, in terms of tasks that, like, again, these things are freshly stood up. We are all figuring it out. But, like, if you had to say, you are director of one of these, like, if you had to say, what are the three specific priorities that such an AI institute should have, what would they be?
It seems like the number one priority is just figuring out what are the baseline tests that make sense for deployers of advanced artificial intelligence. What is the testing that is necessary for them to be doing? Also, it feels like, what are the common evaluations that we should be doing so that we know as a society how to think about the capabilities of these models? Right now, we do, you know, there are some standard evaluations, there are some other evaluations that many people are developing, but I don't, you know, actually, you are obviously much better positioned to answer this question, but, you know, I feel like there's some agreement that we need as an ecosystem on what evaluations make the most sense for these models so that we have a common baseline when we talk about capabilities of what we're talking about. Because, as you know, there's an effort to figure out what is the threshold beyond which we need to test these models. But the threshold is quite difficult to identify for many reasons. You know, is it the amount of money we spent on a model? Is it the amount of flops? Is it the number of chips? You know, these are all things that will have an impact on the capability of the model. But ultimately, what we are asking about is, what is the model capable of? And so these safety institutes can really help us understand how to have a common, a common understanding of model capabilities.
Well, the AI Safety Institute are not the only ones thinking about that. Like, we at OpenAI and some of the other AI labs are doing this too. And also, we have this whole kind of voluntary frameworks. So there is the responsible scaling plan that Anthropic put forward, and OpenAI preparedness framework, which I'm hearing good things about. that is really really good.
It's my favorite, to be honest.
Thank you. Essentially, so the companies are doing this. They come up with this themselves. There's a lot of learning involved in like refining them and learning what works, what doesn't. But like, what is the path forward? Like, what do we think will be next step from this kind of, you know, responsible scaling plans / preparedness frameworks?
I do think that once we have a voluntary or a regulatory ecosystem, I imagine it will look something like the preparedness framework, because I do think there's a lot of recognition in governments that, and the Schumer framework actually, you know, specifically acknowledges that we need regulatory interventions that are quite flexible in terms of so that they remain resilient as the technology evolves. And while, you know, I think people are actually, you know, fans of the preparedness framework and, you know, the responsible scaling policies, we also need to understand, you know, what is that baseline that is shared among companies that are deploying the most capable models. And I think that this work will significantly inform what the safety institutes are doing, but ultimately they will have to promulgate some type of guidance.
Okay. One other thing that I really wonder about when I think about the future of AI, in particular, future of the beneficial AI, is the fact that, well, what is beneficial, we already touched on this, might depend on a position someone is in, community someone belongs to, values someone has. So in the end, like, this is the question that I kind of don't have a good answer to yet. Like, how do we make sure that AI reflects our values, especially as these values differ across, you know, who we are? So, you know, how do you think we should be approaching this problem?
This is a really huge question, Alexander, that I...
That you will easily answer right now.
Well, as you know, we recently released something called the model spec. Mm-hmm. And we asked for feedback in a number of mechanisms to inform how we're actually thinking about shaping the behavior of these models.
So the spec, just to clarify, the spec is kind of our current thinking of like, how should the model behave?
Right. And it is not by any means set in stone. But we did something quite unprecedented here in sharing at this level of granularity. It is a 70-page document.
Well, I heard you like to read like 600-page documents,
yes.
So that's just an easy read.
So we are going to seek feedback on a number of mechanisms, including have a number of engagements around the world with different groups to understand how the different trade-offs we're making here reflect people's needs. Of course, we had a survey that accompanied it, and it really gives us an opportunity to start to, you know, have greater input in conversation. And I would say there's, you know, a lot of research that is already happening at OpenAI on this question. For example, the democratic inputs research, as well as we do have a human data pipeline that is quite diverse. We intentionally source a lot of the AI trainers that review and think about our model behavior from around the world, from different disciplines to really make sure that we're getting that outside expertise. Because I think if it's one thing that we all fervently agree with is that the way that the tools at OpenAI behave should not be shaped purely by the people who work at OpenAI.
I completely agree with this. You know, if you knew me, you would definitely don't want me to be like anywhere close to shaping any model's behavior. So I think this is a good moment to wrap up. But there is now the traditional question, the final question that we have. So as you think about our future with AI, what is one aspect that you are personally looking the most forward to or the least forward to in what AI might bring to us?
You know, Alexander, as you know, my father's family lives in a relatively rural area in Nigeria. And the kinds of services that I have access to on a daily basis are nowhere near what the people that live in the village where I spent a lot of my childhood have access to are just night and day. And the fact that this technology really has this potential to level the playing field and to give people in a lot of these places the kinds of access that I have, it's really incredible. You know, this is why I work here.
Thank you, Anna. This was a fascinating conversation. Today, we had the pleasure to speak with Anna Makandru, who thinks and works deeply on thinking about AI and how it interacts with the governments and the entire world. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please subscribe, leave a comment, and recommend us to your friends. Thanks.